So, welcome to the penultimate experience. That made it sound very important, didn't it? It just means the awards are next hour and then we're done. What we wanted to do in this panel, it's called My Favorite Mormon Book and Why It Matters, so we'll have five people sharing a book that's meant a lot to them and giving some sense for why it's important. When that's done, we'll open up the time for you guys, so if anybody has a favorite Mormon book in the back of your head, you can be thinking about what you'd like to share about it. So without further ado, do you guys want to... Should I introduce all of you? Probably. This is Melissa Leilani Larson, genius playwright and clever Twitterer. Also a TikTok fan. Very good animal. Glenn Gordon is many things, but he's probably here in your capacity as an expert in YA literature, one of the world's experts in Mormon and Jewish YA literature. It's not a lot of people who bring those three fields together quite that way. But I think you get some really interesting insights from that kind of thing. Artist E. Parshall is probably the person who knows the most dead Mormons. Which is not a small achievement. Mormons like dead people. That sounded wrong. She's a historian and has really tracked down just an amazing number of stories of what was everyday life like for different people you've never heard of but really ought to have. So she's here to represent history as a discipline on our panel. And then we have Shayla Miner, who teaches Mormon Lit, writes wonderful things, and is maybe for purposes of this, you read more than I think I could if I spend all my time reading. I don't know how she does it, but she has a review blog where if you're looking for things to read, there's just tons that she's read and given something on there. And then Lance Larson is a great poet, a really interesting and perceptive person, and we invited him because anyone who sees the world quite the way Lance does surely has a reading recommendation for us. So yeah, go ahead and get started and share.
Yeah. I just realized it's interesting because in the two sessions I've attended before this one, there have been questions as to what Mormon literature includes. And as a playwright and a filmmaker, who I started my undergraduate degree at BYU in English, intending to be a novelist. That's where I started. But now I like to say graduated to drama. And it's interesting that if I were to answer this question, the LDS book that has meant the most to me, I actually would, I do have a novel that I'm going to share with you, but then the Eric Samuelson's play Peculiarities was something that, in both the seeing and the reading of it, had a great effect on me, and I think on my work as a writer, also on my thoughts about myself as a Mormon. And so I just wanted to mention that as well, since I do think, as a dramatist, that drama has a place in literature. The novel that I brought to share is Angela Hallstrom's Bound on Earth, which is my favoritist, is that a word now? Because we have an obsession in our society today about superlatives, so it's my favoritist Mormon book. There are some things in it that are really just wonderful. I think the prose is simple and lovely and very straightforward and honest in a way that that Mormons need amongst ourselves and also in the literature that we share outside of Mormondom. The book is broken into vignettes that are very small and encapsulated and can stand on their own. The dramatist in me can see the scenes very, very vividly when I read it. And the characters are all incredibly individual and very real. I think it has a very quiet power to it. I don't know that there's much in it that's, earth-shattering. The drama in it is very small and very ordinary, and that's what is beautiful about it to me. I'm going to read a favorite passage from this. Kyle sits on the swing at the far end of the yard, holding the baby on his lap. He points at the sky. The baby's eye follows his finger. He pushes the swing with his feet, slowly. It is not too cold, and the breeze is very light. The snowflakes are in no hurry. They spin and tumble and land on the baby's coat. He can't remember ever seeing a snowflake up close, and it looks just as it ought to, symmetrical and complicated and beautiful, the way God likes for things to be. He whispers to the baby, "Look." A snowflake has landed on her sleeve. "Look how pretty." The baby will not look. She keeps her chin tilted up at the sky. The sky is a mystery, and snow, and God. His little daughter understands this. Her tiny hands are getting cold. He covers them with his own, leans his cheek against her head. He says, "We can keep each other warm."
The book that I've chosen is a book I think I chose because it affected me emotionally. This isn't an intellectual choice, it's more of an emotional choice. And that's The Way He Lived by Emily Wing Smith. It's her first novel. It was her MFA novel, I think, from Vermont College. And I really responded well to this book because of the way it tackles... It's about a young man who dies at the age of almost 17. And the whole question of the novel, seen from the perspective of various of his family and friends through individual chapters, is to try and get the reader to understand why perhaps he died. Was he motivated to commit suicide in a very kind of odd way, or was it just an accident, a bad thing that happened, and the different perspectives on this young man's life. And I found that the way that Emily wrote this, it was insightful in the sense that every time we look at somebody, we see them from our own perspective. No matter what the complexities of that person may be, it's from what complexities that are in us that we perceive them. And so if you've got a dozen people looking at one individual, you'll get a dozen different understandings and insights and views of that particular individual. And that's really the way that this novel is based on various people's experience with this particular man, young man. And so that's all that I think I have to say about it, except that I think that it's a powerful and well-written book and one that is published by a national publisher. It's a YA book, because YA is what I do. And so I think that that's one that I would heartily recommend.
My favourite historical personage is whoever it is that I'm uncovering at the moment. My favourite book is whatever one I've just been reading. When James invited me to do this, he reminded me that AML's mandate is writing by, for, and about Mormons. So my novel is one that's about Mormons. It's not written by a Mormon. It's the earliest novel. Its title is The Mormonesque, The Trials of Mary Maverick. It's published in 1853 by a man who lived in Illinois. Got ties to half the rest of the country, but based in Illinois. He had some early contacts with Mormons during the Missouri period, and apparently when the Mormons were fleeing from Missouri and heading to what would eventually become Nauvoo, he even sheltered some in his home. Since you've never heard of it, I think, most people, a little bit of a synopsis. A family, the woman Mary Maverick, is a wife and a mother. She is everything that 19th century womanhood needs to be. She is an excellent housekeeper. She's a wonderful wife and mother, loyal and true. She goes beyond the mark as far as doing her housewifely duties. She's an artist, a painter. She also has landscaped her surroundings. She's just what she'd want her to be. Husband's a wonderful man, except for this dreadful thing that he becomes interested in the Mormons. He wants to convert. She's not interested, but she's a loyal wife, and so when he is baptized, she is as well. They move to Jackson County. It's not stated that way, but the center place where the Mormons are gathering at that point. And a terrible thing happens. The mobbers come. Her husband and her son are both killed. It's a very thinly disguised version of Hans Mill. The character, the Maverick family is based on a family that really lived, the Merrick family. It's parents, a daughter, and a son who only by chance happened to be at Hans Mill that day. And the husband and the son were both killed. Mary decides at that point that she's going to be a Mormon. She's given her word, and so the rest of her life is going to be devoted to keeping her word as a Mormon. So we follow her around from one trial to another. I won't tell you spoilers as to how it all ends, but it ends melodramatically and entirely satisfactory for a mid-19th century novel. It's clumsy, as you would expect for novels that are not written by master storytellers. You need a character to carry part of the narrative, and suddenly he's there when he should have been being developed all along. On the other hand, it's quite well done as far as the clues to how the book is going to end, how the problem is going to be resolved, all rests in one or two lines in the first chapter that you don't notice are going to be important until the end. So the man did have some skill. I think it's important, since that's part of the question we've been asked to talk about, partly because as an historical artifact, it's the first novel. It's written by a non-member, but it is not an anti-Mormon novel in any sense. The Mormons are portrayed as being deluded, but it doesn't have that bitter, sharp edge that you get with most anti-Mormon novels. Also, Mary Maverick is a heroine. She does everything right. There's no mistaking that she's meant to be admired. There's nothing in the novel that is particularly Mormon. John Russell, the author, doesn't know what it means to be a Mormon, and so we wouldn't know that Mary Maverick is a Mormon if she didn't keep introducing herself as the Mormoness. But there it is. It's important for other reasons. One is, there have been times in our history when how other people saw us and wrote about us in fiction mattered to us as a people. I'm working on another project right now where the novels of Winifred Graham, an English novelist early in the 20th century, very anti-Mormon, not like the Mormoness at all. It's anti-Mormon from word one, resulted in a request by Parliament to the Home Secretary, whose name was Winston Churchill, to have Mormon missionaries banned from the United Kingdom and curtail the civil rights of English Mormons. Fiction matters. This was when John Russell was writing The Mormoness, books could have affected and made the lives of Mormons different, could have been harsher, could have spurred more Hans Mills because of the feelings that they stirred up. This one treats Mormons, or at least what John Russell thinks a Mormon is, with great respect. And then the second reason why I think it's important is outside non-Mormons look at us and recognize that our story is interesting and is dramatic and is worth basing a narrative on. And this is possibly the first example of that. Thanks.
Okay, I have two books because I cannot choose just one. And I think both of, kind of going back to what Glenn said, I think I'm coming at this from an emotional perspective, and both of these books are books that struck me because my expectation of what I was going to be getting and what I actually got was kind of not unfulfilled, but like surpassed in a way. And the first book I have is The Love Letters of the Angel of Death by Jennifer Quist, and it was published, I think, in 2013. And it, Jennifer Quist is a Canadian author. This is her first novel. She's also a poet and has written short fiction. And what I love about this book is that I was reading it as part of the Whitney Awards. And for those of you who have read for the Whitney Awards, you know it's like drinking from a fire hose. You'd read 40 books in about 2.5 months, which means you don't really read 40 books. You try to read, you know, as much as you can. And a lot of the books are, you know, great, but a lot of them are very plot-driven. A lot of them... And so when I came across this book, and it is a book that forces you to slow down. It's a book that forces you to, you know, just take notice of the beautiful prose. And it's a book that's about... What I love about this book is that it's a book about a happy marriage. It's a book about a happy marriage over a period of years that's still, you know, it's kind of like... You know, a lot of the books in the Whitneys are romance novels, and they end when the couple gets together. And this book starts and kind of takes that story and is never sappy, and there's a delightful, delicious twist that comes about 90% of the way through, where you finally realize who this unnamed narrator of the book is. And so it's one I highly recommend, and it just really touched me at the time because it was so much different from everything else I had been reading up to that point, and was just so beautifully done. And the other novel I have to talk about is one that many of you are probably familiar with, The Miracle Life of Edgar Mitt by Brady Udall. And for me, I had an expectation of this book, which was I knew that it was about a boy who was... led, as he talks over and over in this book, a Dickensian life. And I just finished reading with my students this week. We read The Scholar of Moab. And in The Scholar of Moab, Stephen Peck talks about how his main character, Hiram, lives a Dickensian life. And Hiram, you know, lives in a trailer and dies. And, you know, hard things happen to him. But compared with Edgar Mint's life, Hiram is living like on cloud nine. You know, Edgar Mint gets his head run over by the postman, and then he goes and lives in a dorm for abandoned children, and then he joins the church because he thinks he's going to be able to be sent to live with a family, and he gets sent to live with this Mormon family as part of the Indian Placement Program? Okay, and the family is both awesome and horrible. They are the most dysfunctional family ever, and hilariously dysfunctional. And then, you know, eventually, this is a book that, for me, I kept thinking, how are we going to come out of this and, like, not want to kill ourselves? And it's a book that is really redeeming at the end. It's got such a light touch, and I know that I talked to somebody right before who said they didn't like the book. But for me, it was the matter of coming through such terrible things with this, like, and retaining an optimistic perspective. And Edgar, and for me, that character was something that was a really rewarding read. And, you know, I often think that... when I was in my MFA program, I had a professor, who's not in here right now, who said, kind of, you know, you need to choose between art and entertainment. And I have tried to... I disagreed with that at the moment, and I've disagreed with it ever since. And I've tried to find books, because I'm not writing them myself, tried to find books that kind of disprove this notion. And I think Edgar Mint and The Love Letters of Angel of Death both do that. They're books that both entertain and work as art. And so that's what I appreciate about both of them.
Are you copying?
Okay. I feel like I committed a misstep in not campaigning for poetry, but the book that I have for today is a very old book, 30 years old, Goodbye to Poplar Haven, by Ed Geary, former chair of English department at BYU. I read this 30 years ago, and so when I was invited to this panel, I thought not of my favorite Mormon book, there could be several, but a foundational book, a formative book. So the backdrop for this was I was a first semester graduate student at BYU, and I was taking Introduction to Graduate Studies from Steve Walker. Now this is a very mamby-pamby pass-fail class. Back then it was not. It was very demanding, and we had to do library work, and GPAs were on the line, that sort of thing. And he said, by the way, if you publish something or have something accepted during this semester, then you get an automatic A for this class. And I thought, wow, that looks like a great angle. And so I pinned him down, and I said, so which magazines would count, what sort of genres? And so I pinned him down, and it turned out that if I wrote a review and dialogue about this book, that I could get an A. And, so I did. But it was a very easy review to write because I loved the book so much. So let me just focus on four reasons that I like the book. First of all, and like Ed Geary's style and authenticity as a writer, first of all, he had literary ambitions. This is what he said in an interview, I think. Or no, actually, he says it in an essay here. Indeed, my private boyhood name for the town, replacing the prosaic Huntington, this is where he grew up, was Poplar Haven. And I used to imagine myself immortalizing it in fiction someday as Joyce did his Dublin or Faulkner his Jefferson. So I like the fact that he was writing about his experience, but that he had this larger backdrop, and that filtered into the writing. It wasn't just this sort of parochial history of a town in Utah. The second thing that I like about it is that he has a fantastic ear for vernacular voice and folkloric hyperbole. Here's a passage from a story called The War Teacher. This person is talking about being haunted by unsleeping ghosts of Gadianton robbers. He says, they was moving along in the trees at the side of the road. When I stopped, they stopped, and it was as still as death. When I begun to move again, they begun to. Well, I begun to call on the Lord, you bet. I told him that if he would help me out this here one time, I'd stay clear of beer joints and wouldn't do nothing to offend him. And lo and behold, a great light. It was something like the moon, but it wasn't no moon. It didn't shine nowhere else, only just round about me. I was protected, you see, and they daresn't come any closer. Next morning, though, we found our sheep dead and not a mark on them. So I love his ability to take the everyday and find a place for it in this essay that he wrote. The third thing that I like about his work, and this is from an essay called Hind to Kolob, is that he understands the importance of showing rather than telling. About the same time, I was immersed in the essays of Eugene England, essays which I liked very much, but they tended to be deductive, and they tended to be calls to arms and so forth, which I loved very much, but that wasn't a congenial mode for me personally. And so I found in Ed Geary a kind of memoiristic essay that I think was a better fit for me. So he starts out by talking about two contrasting views of the afterlife. One was portrayed by his bishop, Leonard, who said that the dead live with us right here. And the other is portrayed by a brother, Crandall, who said that when we die, we're changed in the twinkling of an eye and we fly immediately to Kolob. So kind of interesting theologically, but rather than talk about them in this abstract way, he centered them in actual characters. So there was a kind of dialectical movement or some sort of duality in the work. And that was characterized further in a guy named Bert Westover, who's this old crotchety guy who ends up having this conversation with the grave man. And so I just thought I'd read a passage from that as well. So he's of two minds. They're discussing the dead and resurrection. And at first, this brother assumes that he believes in the resurrection, and he describes what might happen afterwards. So this is a conversation. Well, he drawled, you're in a good line, ain't you? As long as folks keep dying. The headstone man would nod agreeably. Surest thing in the world, he said, tilting his chair back against the side of the van. Course, you'll be out of a job come Resurrection Day. Bert Westover paused to draw in a cigarette or spit into the canal. the yellowish bubbles drifting lightly on the water until they hit a rapid stretch and disintegrated. Hell of a time that'll be. People crawling out of the ground like salamanders in a mud puddle. I figure to move away from here before then. Mine's the first place they'll hit when they come over the hill, and they'll eat me out of house and home. And then just a couple paragraphs later, you have this Burt Westover turning things over and sort of testing the water, and this is what he says. One evening, Burt told of digging up a mummified Indian years before when he was working on the county road. He was all folded up till he wasn't no longer than that, he said, holding his hands 3 feet apart. Smart way of burying. You don't need such a big hole. The headstone man pursed his lips in professional disapproval. But Brett had found a line of talk he wanted to pursue. Tough job getting the kinks out on Resurrection Day, though. He spat again. Nah, when you've dug up a corpse or two, you can't swallow the resurrection business. When you're dead, you're dead. So he doesn't insist on one perspective. Even in the same character, he gives us this duality, and he presents it and lets the reader decide. And in a sense, we're in the position of this young boy who's eavesdropping on these life-changing conversations, trying to figure out what he believes about the afterlife and whether there is resurrection. Finally, the last thing that I like about his work is that he gave me an early taste of how to write about childhood and how to situate yourself towards an audience. The pieces in this collection were published in Deseret News and Dialogue, so he had in mind a Mormon audience, but it wasn't a doctrinaire Mormon audience. He wasn't trying to prove doctrine. Instead, he was trying to present. Right now, I'm working on a childhood memoir in prose, and I find myself going back to some of those same lessons, that if I can learn only to tell a story vividly and present the felt truth, that all the other beliefs are in a sense secondary, but that it will be available to this larger audience. So he was very helpful to me.
So I think the second part of things is to open up the conversation to you for any questions or also for any thoughts you'd like to share as far as your Mormon book that matters most.
The first question is the Mormonist on Project Gutenberg, or is it available anywhere else?
It isn't easily available now. Is it all right if I say?
Lloyd?
Copeland Books has agreed to reprint a lot of the earliest novels that Mike Austin is working on doing critical editions of. So soon. We'll need somebody to call on people.
When Al mentioned Mormon drama and that Mormon literature goes in other directions as well, are there any pieces from all of you that particularly appreciated in another genre other than novels?
My students just finished reading two plays, I Am Jane and Gaddy Anton. And Gaddy Anton was a huge hit among my Mormon Lit students. And, I mean, we had a really, really fun time with both of them.
There's a book two or three years old now, Between Pulpit and Pew, Folklore. So there are chapters in there, and it's very much like the kind of literature we're talking about. Chapters in there about Cain and Bigfoot, and about flying saucers, and Mormon connections to some of these ideas.
I think one of the back in the 80s, when I was living in LA, I picked up a copy of LDSF, which was kind of the first anthology of Mormon science fiction, or science fiction with a Mormon theme. And that was a really interesting book for me, because it was a series of short stories, but it caused me to think about the what-ifs in a different way, because it was presented with... And it's the same with... there's a Jewish equivalent, anyway. And so, you know, looking at... using that Mormon lens to look at something that is not, doesn't seem to have the slightest thing to do with Mormonism is an interesting thing to be able to do. And I think one of the things I like about this novel is that it was published by a national publisher and it's completely unapologetically Mormon. It's not, I think very often Mormon literature published on the national market is apologetic, or not even apologetic, but explanatory. It goes to great lengths to say that this is what this is why we do this, this is what a temple is, this is what family home evening is, or whatever, in the belief that the reader needs to have this kind of huge backstory in order to comprehend the characters, and that's just not true. And this doesn't do any of that, it just says it. You know, so it talks about church, it talks about Mormons, it talks about bishops, it talks about, and it's just, it says it. And you know, and I think that works really well. I think people are intelligent enough not to need this huge backstory every time. Anyone else?
Anyone have a favorite book they want to share? Yes.
I actually just recently discovered a book that is quickly becoming just an absolute favorite of mine, and I discovered it just by accident on WorldCat doing a variety of different searches for Mormons in literature from 1930 to 1940, because that's the period that I'm working on right now. And this book is called Poplars Across the Moon. Have you ever heard of Poplars Across the Moon?
A copy was delivered to me yesterday because of your recommendation.
I've been trying to sell people on it. It's by Lee Neville, but that's a pseudonym. The writer was Lila Horn Richard, who was an Episcopalian who spent most of her life in Salt Lake City. And she was probably the first Utah-based young adult novelist. In 1912, she started a series called Bluebell, the Texas Debutante, which was written for young girls. It's about a Texas girl who goes all over the country. She was not a Mormon, but she lived most of her life among the Mormons. And this book, I had no idea what to expect, but it just blew me away. Two orphan girls are adopted by the most loving Mormon family you could ever imagine. They're also Danish. And they're raised Mormon and with just the most self-sacrificing mother and patient father that could possibly be. One of them just doesn't believe and has a faith crisis and doesn't know how to deal with it because she has such a hard time dealing with the love that her parents had and the sacrifices that were made for her, but she's very attracted to, well, the Episcopal Church, which makes sense given the author. The other one is so loyal to her family that she never questions whether or not she believes. She just knows that her mother, who gave everything for her, wants her to be Mormon. And it plays out these two girls' relationships with each other and with their parents in a way that is so modern and deals with so many things that are at issue right now that I just have to keep going back to the copyright page and reading 1936 on this, and realizing that this Utah writer found very early in the game one of the most important things about Mormonism, which is the way that a loving, supportive community pulls you in sometimes against your will, and showed in a very mature way about these two young girls dealing with it. I'm going to recommend that to everybody. That's my recommendation. There are, I think, like three copies in the world left now. They're artists, and I got it.
So mine's signed by the author.
Yeah, there were about six copies on Amazon, and now they're down to two. So hurry! But it's just
what was it called again?
Poplars Across the Moon, and Lee Neville is the author. And she didn't try to hide the fact that she wrote it. She just didn't want it interfering with her other line of children's books, so she created it. She went around all over Salt Lake lecturing about it, but she just, for her national audience, she didn't want it all confused.
Scott.
I have a 1992 book from Signature called Honorable Release by David Gagan. And I only know of two other people who've read it. One is Levina Fielding Anderson, because she has a blurb on here. And the other one is Levi Peterson, because he has a blurb on here. And I've read it twice. It's not a deeply philosophical novel. It's actually a murder mystery and an adventure and kind of... you want me to read the little thing on the back? A madman bent on revenge rampages through Rio de Janeiro, murdering American missionaries. A cleric turned mystic copes the hills gathering disciples. Their paths converge as a Yankee journalist and a jaded American ex-missionary race to prevent a violent showdown. And I love it.
I remember when that was talked about on the AML listserv.
Really? I've never heard it talked about. Or maybe that was me.
Probably very soon after it came out. But I hadn't thought of it since.
Yeah. I loaned my copy to somebody and never got it back. And I was down at Pioneer Books a couple months ago browsing, and I found this. And so even though I couldn't afford it, I bought it. Just so I can have it again. And then I read it.
Yes, sir.
I was thinking, it may not like this book, but I think it's reflective of how much we've changed in our times, and that is a book called Goodbye, I Love You. Mm. I forget who the author is.
We know it.
But I think that when I first read the book 35 years ago, I cried. Mm. And but I don't, you know, today, if you were to write a book like that, does anyone have any opinions?
Or it'd be made into a miniseries, probably.
Yeah.
I did my paper on that book last year. One of the women in the audience said, she said, I mean, Carolyn Pearson is really an interesting figure in Mormon literature, because for some people, she was Mormon poetry at a given point. And for some people, she was bad Mormon poetry. And so it's hard to tell her to map out her place. And afterwards, one of the women who was in the session came and said, yes, that's true. And after this book was published, a lot of people thought she went over the edge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that. But it's very... I was really impressed, because it takes things that are really deeply troubling and presents them without... She presents a lot of really painful things without causing the audience to be in the deep pain, without presenting herself as a really, really angry person.
Yeah.
But she is able to present herself as someone in deep pain. Mm. Quite interesting.
Mm. There's one that I like called Pictograph Murders. It's in... I just have to put that in. And it's in kind of this, she's a convert to the church, Southern Utah, and they're Indian. And it's kind of this metaphysical, where it's got this trickster narrative with an Indian coyote, the Navajo on the Navajo reservations. It's kind of this clash between the Navajo and Utah culture down instead of Utah, maybe Mormon culture down there. But it's your comments about entertainment and art kind of fusing, that made me think of that novel, because it was just, it was a, kind of a thriller, kind of a murder mystery, but also very very beautiful, very mythical in a lot of ways. So that was a very beautiful novel.
I might just inject another comment, but... Chris Crowe's Death Coming Up the Hill, which is a brand new YA novel that was recently published, is, to me, that's an extraordinary book. It's written entirely in haiku, and it's just, you read it so quickly because it's in a poetic form, but the impact is incredibly powerful. I just loved it.
I totally second that. That's the book that I've read this year that's totally blown me away. And I read it during 1 hour when my kids watched Peppa Pig in the other room. I've been thinking about it ever since.
Yeah, it's amazing book. Death Coming Up the Hill.
I believe by Chris Crowe. One syllable for each person killed in Vietnam.
In 1963. Yeah.
So these aren't necessarily two of my favorite novels, but I think they're interesting novels, and I'm very pleased to hear what others think of them. And one's actually not a novel, I guess it's a memoir. The World's Strongest Librarian. Have you read that one?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I heard you do with the
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has Tourette syndrome. And anyway, very interesting, and very much about his Mormonism and about his Mormon upbringing. Have you read it? She liked it. And then the other one is the other novel by Greg Udall. Is it just The Polygamist?
The Lonely Polygamist.
Yeah, and I'm curious. I was so interested that it didn't receive more attention. I mean, like, I don't think it won an AML award or people turned. I mean, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was. I think it did okay nationally, but within the church, I don't think.
Directly with Stephen Peck
that year.
It's 2010.
Stephen Peck kind of wins all this. But I'm pretty sure that
there's an anthology of Mormon sci-fi called Mormon, they're called Monsters of Mormons that came out in 2011.
Yes.
And I've been working my way slowly through it for professional reasons, all day. But I sent them on my desk at work, and people always like, oh, what is this? And every time I want to sell people on, I told them about one specific story. For me, I like most of the stories, but some of them are kind of nervous in terms of recommending them to others. But one of the ones I really like is about this missionary companionship, and they're out in the field doing, you know, tracking and stuff. And a zombie apocalypse breaks out.
Yes, I love that.
And they have to decide, okay, what do we do? Like, this is not in our handbook, you know. and they decide, you know, do we go home? Do we like it? Everybody's just kind of, you know, crazy, whatever. And they decide, no, we were called to serve a mission. We need to stay out in the field. So we will kill, we'll try and find people to teach who aren't zombies. And when we do find zombies, we'll kill them, and then we'll baptize them for the dead. And it's like, and it's kind of a field baptism for the dead, and so that, you know, they have to, but they, you know, that's how they figured out, and they don't have, the mission president, I don't know, they don't have any contact. So this is going through, just kind of trying to be like good missionaries in the middle of the zombie apocalypse, and you know, it's actually a very touching story at the end, but yeah, I just love that, you know.
That was
great. I don't remember who wrote that specific.
William Morris.
Anthologies.
So good. Yeah.
I'll find out. Okay.
Jesse, you had your hand up too.
I was going to talk about, I can never choose a favorite book. I hate it when people always write their own book. But there's one that came out a few years ago called The Reluctant Blogger by Ryan Mayfield.
Oh, yeah.
That I kind of wish it was talked about and read more. The conceit of blogging is kind of, that's one aspect of the book that doesn't work so well. And part of I think why I liked it is because I read a lot of women's fiction, both Mormon and non. And this is a similar book, but from the perspective of a contemporary young Mormon man. And I think it is a perspective that we don't get in our literature very much, because it's very introspective. His wife suddenly dies, and it's about him having to deal with all of his, you know, I think, and again, like I said, I tend to have a lot of conversations about women in the church and women's issues. And I think men are experiencing a lot of the same problems, and no one talks about them. And I found it a very insightful book, because, you know, he has to deal with suddenly losing his wife, getting back to the dating scene in his 30s, dealing with his calling in the fish break, or if he was in fish break, they please him, and being a provider and all the pressure of being a single parent while providing her family and being more than dad and all of the expectations. And it was very, it also was really good. It wasn't sensationalistic, you know, and it was just very earnest, I thought, and very interesting and a really unique perspective that I think we ought to get more in our writing, both nonfiction and fiction.
I was cataloging that book, and I was just flipping through it, because you kind of have to flip through it to look through stuff. And I just kind of hit on a random page and started reading, and then I'd get sucked into it and like finish the chapter. And I thought, well, this is, you know, and then I had to go back and read it and figure out what the context was. But yeah, I thought it was really cool.
It unfortunately was in a year where there were so many stories that came out about a spouse dying.
Yeah.
But it was like, there were so many of the fiction books that came out that year were about dead spouses, and I think that it suffered with the But I agree. It was really
It's also hard to sell people.
I have three. One is I Can't Tell a Life by Florence Child Brown. It was published, and then her children kind of threatened to sue her, and Marilyn Brown kind of withdrew it, but it's on her website. It's a lovely memoir, and very, very honest. She tells us really painful things, but never tells us how she wants us to think about them. She just presents her life and lets it go. The other one is Raw Edges by Phyllis Barber, which is the middle between How I Got Closer to Nevada memoir and To the Mountain. Raw Edges is a very, very intense, and it carries a really strong sense of post-traumatic stress, even though she doesn't use the term, but it's a very intense journey story. Cindy riding a bike ride she made from Denver to
Vermont somewhere, right?
Yeah, Vermont, yeah, yeah, where she's in their graduate program in the summer. Very intense and wonderful story. And then the third one is called Southern Paiute, a Portrait. I think the photographer's named Hebner, and I'm not sure the editor, but there's a story there. One of the men they interviewed, his grandfather witnessed the Mountain Meadows Massacre, said, "They're going to blame us for this. Left Southern Utah and went to Nevada, and found a town in Nevada." But it's a wonderful, really wonderful portrait of an endangered and dying culture and language. I recommend this one. It's published by USU, and the cover photo was on their catalog a few years ago when it came out.
I think Bruce had it too.
Yeah, I have too many favorites, so I can't do this right. But I was thinking about the first book. There were probably two books, and I can't be sure which one was the very first one that alerted me to the existence of something that could be called Mormon literature. And so I mentioned them. There was a little book published by BYU Press, two plays by Clinton Larson, poetic drama. I don't know if they would ever work on stage. Cory Antimer and Moroni. But still interesting. I reread one of them a couple of years ago. The other was Virginia Sorensen's Where Nothing Is Long Ago. I bought myself a copy, loved it so much I bought my mother a copy, which belonged to the same generation as Sorensen. I never had a conversation with my mother about it. This is a terrible thing. So those books told me there is something. Now, there was a whole lot more already, but those told me there isn't. And then someone who's neglected, who I read a good deal of a couple of years ago, is Richard Scowcroft. His first novel was reviewed rather cruelly by, John A. Widso, who was a pretty astute reader, I got to give him that. But it reviewed in the... Improvement Era, John A. Widso, who was editor of the Improvement Era at the time. And if you want to know why the lost generation got lost, read Widso's reviews of Scowcroft, Sorensen, and Maureen Hooper. That'll tell you something about that. And it's a good thing for apostles and for all the rest of us that apostles don't review. Sure, we're all glad. It's a win-win.
I think there's an underground blog.
They send them out anonymously. But I read all of Scowcroft's novels. The guy was a good writer. He was the teacher of Scott Turow, of Tobias Wolfe, and probably numerous other people, too. Founded the Stanford Creative, almost. He was in at the beginnings of the Stanford Creative Writing Program. But a really interesting comic novelist. He stopped presenting his stories as Mormon and having Mormon characters after that first one. But you read them and you say, this is Utah Mormon culture. Wherever She Goes is the one I think I might recommend the most. I'm still reading the very last of them. Scowcroft. It's too bad. Oblivion waits for you too, Lance.
You must be somebody
here. Right in this room, Lance and Doug and Scott and oh my gosh, you know. But that's the set. But a conversation like this is a good thing to have. It's the way one's reading life goes, right? Word of mouth.
Yeah.
Or the blurb.
Speaking of Doug, we did really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remembered Margaret Blair's Young's Salvador, so on that night. A recently divorced woman goes to South America, and the issues it brings up in that, I mean, I don't want to spoil that book at all, so I don't talk much about it, but about authority and about forgiveness and various different things in that book, I thought were beautiful.
I just wanted to. My gateway to Mormon literature after being in contemporary fiction for a long time was Backslider by Levi Peterson. And I just, when I got to the cowboy Jesus, I was in tears. And it just it was so empathetic. And so I really loved that. And then that. Then I got into my great writing teacher, Doug Thayer, his stories and things like that. And now, after seeing what Stephen Peck can do, you know, I'm like, this is just, there's some incredible stuff out there. So it's good to be able to talk about it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think we're not...